You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 21st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, attorney and co-host of Law and Disorder Radio, Heidi Boghossian, author of I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. Also on the program today, the Delta variant is now 83% of all U.S. infections. As the average mortality life expectancy drops in this country in 2020. Meanwhile, infections hit the U.S. Capitol, and the Republican Party apparently has begun to reverse on its vaccination hesitancy stance. They haven't reversed on the infrastructure. Republicans look to block the procedural vote on the Portman Cinema infrastructure bill today. Negotiations supposedly to continue. Determine how Lucy will once again pull back the football. The bootleg fire in Oregon is literally generating its own weather and dumping smoke in New York City. Trumpista Thomas Barak indicted on lobbying charges. And in a big boon for trustbusters, Biden appoints anti-monopolist Jonathan Cantor to head the DOJ antitrust division. New report, U.S. healthcare debt, double previous estimates, and it is now the largest source of debt in collections in the country. Mitch McConnell saying Republicans will once again try to block a raising of the U.S. debt limit. And an Obama-appointed federal judge blocks the Arkansas abortion ban. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma is out today for a non-serious sickness. She just has an eye infection. I mean, I don't want to talk out of turn, but... I don't want anybody to worry that it's something more serious. She'll be back tomorrow. Nothing to worry about. Appreciate you joining us today. It is we're watching basically as things with the Delta variant become a little bit more scary, frankly. It is now taken over as the primary source of COVID infections. I feel like it was only like 3 or 4 weeks ago when we were saying this was something that, you know, we were anticipating in the future. But it is here now. And there does seem to be, and we'll talk more about this in the second half of the program, there does seem to have been some type of memo that went out to right-wing talkers. Regarding some politicians regarding their vaccination hesitancy. It's unclear whether it was a question of polling. Maybe they saw some internal polls. Maybe they started to see some of these horrible, horrible stories coming out of places like Alabama. You have doctors going on Facebook, really just lamenting is too, I think, is not a serious enough a word, but they have patients who are telling them that, you know, asking them, you know, can I have the vaccine now? As they are dying. And the doctors are like, it doesn't work that way. People who got their information from Facebook or other social media or Republican politicians or their news, which would be somewhere between Fox and OWN or WorldNet Daily or whatnot, and they're dying of what they thought was a hoax. It's a horror show. It's a real horror show. And of course, children under the age of 12 have no opportunity to get vaccinated at this point. And so they have, regardless, they're at the mercy of all these people who are not, you know, going out and getting vaccinations. Yeah, I was, we'll read that quote from Dr. Cobia, who was a doctor in an Alabama hospital. It really is a horrific, horrific story. Meanwhile, apparently we're supposed to celebrate the fact that someone who has made billions upon billions upon billions of dollars over the course of this pandemic, who built an empire based upon essentially skirting sales tax for an extended period of time, as Amazon did. We're supposed to celebrate the fact that this guy has so much money that he decided to just almost like a hobby to go to space. And somehow we're supposed to celebrate this, as opposed to the idea that, hey, maybe someone shouldn't have that much money. Here's Jen Psaki in the White House press room. You know, I'm not saying I expected them to denounce Jeff Bezos for having this much money that he can go just take a joyride into space. But this is, this I don't appreciate.
This is a moment of American exceptionalism. That's how we see it. It will be the ingenuity of all of our commercial partners to help us continue advancing to the next of our the next stage of our nation's space exploration. And investments in space create jobs, can improve life here on Earth through climate monitoring and medical advancements, just to name a few.
First off, I don't know how it is an example of American exceptionalism. Isn't the guy from Virgin Airlines, he's sending one into space as well? He's British. And we've seen the Chinese and the Russians and the French. Just off the top of my head, send people into space. And to the extent that it is exceptional, maybe it's exceptionally bad that we have someone who has so many billions of dollars that they literally, I mean, didn't he say years ago, like, I don't know what to do with all my money. Maybe I got to go to Mars. And it is, I don't know. This goes up there in the annals with George Bush's response to a woman who says she's working three jobs in a town hall. And he says, uniquely American with pride. Here is Jeff Bezos reminding everybody. And I would also say that, like, you know, if the value of these projects is so significant in terms of what we're getting out of it, in terms of science and whatnot, and I believe there's an argument for that, then we should be, the collective we, as embodied in our government, should be doing this. Not Jeff Bezos should not determine what we get out of these things. And the way that we can afford to do it is by not making the policy choice that we're going to allow people to amass this many billions of dollars. So if we think there's value, we should tax him. Meanwhile, here's Jeff Bezos wearing his made-up uniform that he paid for.
Like the worst Armageddon sequel.
It's really unbelievable. Maybe we should do that too. Maybe we should do some Majority Report space suits.
Yeah.
But here we go.
I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this. So seriously, for every Amazon customer out there and every Amazon employee, thank you from the bottom of my heart very much. It's very appreciated.
So for every Amazon driver out there or a factory or a warehouse worker who has had to pee in a bottle or has had to run around as if they were a gerbil in a gerbil maze, constantly timed under that pressure, thank you. And in some ways, you're welcome. I'm sure there was a lot of pride for a lot of those Amazon workers seeing that made-up uniform.
Do you think they got a break to wash it?
Well, yeah, I doubt it.
In the warehouses?
I doubt it. They probably would get docked. We'll play it. We're going to dock you the 8 minutes.
Recognition is certainly better than a raise, in my opinion.
Without a doubt. But could there be a better illustration of what is problematic about billionaires in this country than the idea of watching them like on a whim, I want to be an astronaut, and I do it.
And not even doing like astronaut like science experiments, going up there and throwing Skittles around in zero gravity.
The idea is that, look, he is going to fulfill his agenda in going into space. Not one that is best necessarily for a society. And we this is an extension of what we saw with the Gates Foundation in literally derailing education in this country for decades. And I say that by their own admission in their own RAND report. Jeff Bezos deserves the Vic Berger treatment, as far as I'm concerned. And Vic Berger, master filmmaker, has provided. Here is an instant classic from Vic Berger, an edit of the Bezos brothers, trying to be relatable after their space travel.
Right in the middle of the most intense 5G section, they asked me how I was doing, and I was like, I'm doing okay. So, it was pretty intense. I was like, I'm doing okay. So you're just looking out, and that was probably the most profound thing, was looking at the Earth's atmosphere and seeing how teensy it is. Did you feel that? It's life-sustaining and teensy. You look at this thing, and you see how small you are. You see that the world is big. You see the atmosphere is small and teensy. You know, this world is full of not enough unifiers and too many vilifiers. And when you get up there, you see that we are one world. This is one planet. We should have a lot of unifiers.
There's Jeff Bezos realizing how tiny the planet is, and how big his money is in some respects. It's almost like his opening statement, his opening announcement that he's going to be king of the world. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to Heidi Boghossian. She's an attorney and co-host of Law and Disorder Radio, author of I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. We'll be right back after this. Folks, today's program is sponsored, at least in part, by Stitch Fix. For me, I think everybody knows that I'm a little bit sartorially challenged. One of the things I'm trying to do as I get older is to be a little bit more deliberate in how I set things up around myself and how I dress myself. It's going fair. Emma's usually around to remind me, like, hey, you shouldn't cut your hair by just seeing something stick out in the Zoom camera and then just take a pair of scissors and cut at it. Still working on some of those things, but the way I dress has gotten a little bit better, ladies and gentlemen. Why is that? Because as much as I hate to shop, Stitch Fix has made it easier for me, and it can do the same for you. Stitch Fix offers clothing that is hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, style, and budget. Every piece is chosen for your fit, for your life, the colors you like, so that you can look and feel your best. This is what happens. They send you a collection of clothes. They call a fix. You try them on at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. Stitch Fix has free shipping and easy returns or exchanges. They have a prepaid return envelope is included. There's no subscription required. You just pay $20 for a styling fee for each box, which gets credited toward any piece that you keep. There's no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit any occasion. They have it for women. They have it for men. They have it for kids. They ship all over the U.S. and now available in the U.K. as well. And you can just go there and browse through stuff that they suggest to you. And you don't even need a full box. You just get it. Like, for instance, I guess it was about a month ago, I got two shirts. One was my casual Friday, I thought, an adding to that. And the other was, you know, a go out on the town type of thing. So I got a gray polo I ordered, and I got a sort of a seersucker short sleeve blue one. I think it's called the Riley or something. And they sent them. The polo did not look like I had wanted it to. The seersucker, which I thought would be the thing that I returned, I ended up loving. In fact, I think Brendan said it was slimming on me. And I appreciated that, Brendan.
You're welcome, Sam. I truly meant it.
I kept the seersucker. I returned the polo. I returned the polo. It took me about 30 seconds. Super easy. And now I have a shirt that I don't think I would have ever even attempted to try on in a store, basically because I don't like to go into stores. So it's been very helpful in terms of like upgrading my sartorial presentation. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix at stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix, stitchfix.com/majority. And one of the things I've also been trying to do lately is, well, not lately. I mean, now for almost like over a year. And I'm getting better and trying to remember to do it. But when I can't sleep well, times when I have a little bit of anxiety, which happens on occasion, I take 10 minutes and I dive into Headspace. Headspace can do the same for you. It is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. It's one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. There are 25 published studies on Headspace benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, over 60 million downloads. Need some help falling asleep? Feeling a little overwhelmed? I'm checking off both these boxes. Very often. Headspace has wind down session and 3-minute SOS meditations. It really makes a difference. There are even meditations for kids. I know that my daughter has used this to great effect. Tough time, particularly over COVID. A lot of anxiety for kids who are sort of like aware of what's going on, but also not sort of like necessarily at the point where they can sort of absorb it. And the beauty about Headspace, it works on your schedule anytime and anywhere. Super easy to use, super helpful. If you got 3 minutes, you can make yourself feel a little better. And as you do it more, you increase the efficacy too. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/majority. That's headspace.com/majority. for a free one-month trial. You get access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/majority today. All right. I want to welcome to the program Heidi Boghossian, attorney and co-host of the Law of Law and Disorder Radio. She is the author of I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. Heidi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there were two things that came up today just that I thought were really apt in terms of some of your myths. I mean, there is, and we'll get to it. There's obviously a big story right now about some spyware coming from an Israeli company and how it's been used with journalists and activists. But your book is also, I think, a little bit more focused, or I should say is focused on sort of like the everyday, like, you know, why your average person this should be should understand what is problematic about this. There are 21 myths. Let's just start with the I have nothing to hide, and so I shouldn't be worried about surveillance. Why is that a myth?
It's a myth because everyone has something to hide. The issue is, do we want to exercise autonomy and decide who we reveal personal information to? I think a lot of people think that so-called criminals are the only ones that this applies to in terms of government surveillance, the myth that it makes us safer. And so we want to help the government by turning over our information. The problem is we have so many laws in the United States, many old laws that have been on the books, never used. But if someone does something, for example, a whistleblower who may speak out against a government injustice, like the whistleblower Daniel Hale, who revealed the covert drone program and is being sentenced in a few days, if the government wants to, they can pick through a selection of offenses, minor or otherwise, that may not have been unlawful years ago, and they can use it against a person to make the case for prosecution. I also think people need to remember that in our nation, our laws provide that we are all innocent until proven guilty. And I think we're at danger of risking increased attention and monitoring of individuals who run against the status quo, who question authority, who don't look like us, the others who were so often targeted throughout history. And we need to realize that we have to control our information. If the government suspects criminal activity, they need to go to court and get a warrant for it.
Let's talk about the when you write about the spiral of silence. Explain what that concept is to us, and I mean, because I feel like there's a lot of nuance in that concept, and it's important to sort of investigate that.
Well, that fits into another myth that is we don't change how we act when we know we're being monitored. After the 2013 Ed Snowden revelations of NSA warrantless spying, a lot of people became more careful about what they said on social media, in-person gatherings, online, in emails. You know, after 2001, we heard stories about people. I remember an individual who went into a post office and asked for stamps that did not have an American flag on it. And the post office workers flagged that person. I think DH, the Department of Homeland Security, questioned him. So in times of perceived crisis, and I think feeding into the whole surveillance apparatus, which ignited but had been with us for a long time after the events of 9/11, people began realizing that if you mention a bomb or anything that has to do with a plot or words that would trigger, say, an algorithm on social media flagging you, people became more conscious that what they say can impact how others, including the government, responds to them, making them more suspicious. So the spiral of silence is when we self-edit, we self-censor, and we don't fully participate in the so-called marketplace of free ideas because we're afraid that if we say something that doesn't fit into the general status quo, we may attract attention.
Like, I think that on some level that there's a there's a nuance to that, right? I mean, because self-censoring itself is not in and of itself, it seems to me, problematic. I mean, there are things that I will not say on this program because I feel like they're irresponsible to say, or because, you know, within the context of what I'm doing here, the same thing in, like, if I'm in a group of five or six people and I don't know a couple of them, or, you know, I mean, I have different delineations, and there are times where I self-censor myself. I mean, certainly, like, you know, we're hearing from people on the right who are like, you know, I'm self-censoring myself. I'm not getting out there and talking about, you know, what I think about. I think Texas today, the Texas Senate voted to nix a teaching requirement that calls white supremacy morally wrong. Because it's not right to sort of, like, you know, keep people from expressing their views. There's two sides to this. Was the KKK bad? Well, you know, most people say yes, but some people say no. You shouldn't make the people who say no feel bad, right? I mean, so it's not self-censoring itself is not not in and of itself necessarily problematic. It's the reasons why you self-censor.
It's the reasons why we self-center. I mean, thinking that you may be called a terrorist, thinking that you may be, for example, lose a teaching job, which has happened a lot in the last 15 or 20 years, because you identify or you explain an issue, say Palestine versus Israel, in a way that funders and others don't like. I think what's more problematic is if you stop engaging in relationships, in activities, in protests, for example, at a time when I think people really do need to go forth and express their viewpoints. I think that when we curb our behavior so that it changes the decisions we make because of fear of retribution, then we become like a more restrictive society that really, an autocracy where individual freedom is diminished. And as that practice continues, it becomes more comfortable to give up the freedoms that we're accustomed to exercising.
I guess what I'm asking is it, I mean, do we need a level of, I mean, because under the rubric you're presenting, that it would be wrong to say to someone like, hey, I don't want to hang out with you if you think that the KKK wasn't wrong. Like, I mean, because on some level, what, you know, there has been a project in this country, you know, I guess maybe as long, you know, for an extended period of time, but, you know, to sort of say, like, racism is bad, let's say, or sexism is bad. And it's not appropriate to articulate these ideas, and that there isn't an attempt to sort of say, like, you are going to be isolated socially if you espouse these things, versus a realm of dissent. I mean, we make these judgments all the time, right? And it's really a question of, like, you know, how these judgments are made,
and that very question of how those judgments are made feeds into other prongs of the surveillance apparatus. So that, for example, algorithms that law enforcement use based on inequalities, say in a certain community where African Americans may have been arrested or racially profiled more than other communities, gives them a rap sheet. That data is then put into a new algorithm as part of so-called predictive policing. The problem is you're putting in bad data that was gathered by individuals who had obviously certain biases that hopefully are starting to come to the fore now with criminal justice reform. But I think the issue, it's not just limited to self-censorship per se, it infects the threat hanging over many of us of being called a terrorist, or in a chapter that I have on a neighborhood, if you see something, say something, turning right. citizens in effect into local police officers. What we see is a lot of misinformation based on individual biases that cause someone to say, oh, there's a woman standing on the corner looking suspicious. Her skin may be darker. She may be wearing a hijab, but it's all interconnected to the other facets of surveillance. And I think one of the large issues is the government and corporations say they're doing all of this to keep us safe. That has not been proven with any evidence. In fact, the whistleblower Daniel Hale that I just mentioned came forth with information about the secret drone program under Bush and Obama that may have killed as many as 4,000 individuals who were on a watch list with potentially false data that was fed into that. So I think we can't really set, my chapters are segmented out, but they're right. all part of the same problem.
I want to get to a couple more of the myths in particular, but you know, I remember in the days after 9/11, there was a plan that was proposed by the Bush administration called TIPS, and I think it was Terrorism Information and Prevention System or something to that effect. And this was, and I think it was Ashcroft, had proposed essentially deputizing postmen, cable, cable installers, phone installers, electric meter checkers, anybody who goes to the homes, they would set up a way of reporting. Like, this guy has a Che Guevara poster in his apartment or something to that effect. It never actually happened, but I'm not convinced because it was such public outcry about it. But I'm not convinced that if we had a 9/11 today, the things that have changed that the wake of 9/11 actually brought about in terms of the Department of Homeland Security and all of the laws that followed that haven't sort of like tilled the ground for a broader acceptance of that. I mean, we have a law that was just passed, I think it was in Texas as well, about abortion, where the state does not police whether someone's had an abortion. It sets up a civil procedure where basically it deputizes everybody to go seek out somebody who's had an abortion and report them and sue them. I mean, what is your sense of that tilling of the ground?
I agree completely. That Ashcroft program didn't pass per se, but I think it exists in many different formats. The neighbors spying on one another is one. We also have Amazon's Ring, which is wildly popular, that in many jurisdictions works with police departments to share information. Now, what they do, they'll share videos of neighbors or individuals coming to your door that's been captured on your Ring camera. They ostensibly give the owner of the camera permission to opt out, but as often happens, when people are given that option, they usually tend to comply because they're afraid that saying no may raise a flag of suspicion about them. But I think what we have is different tentacles, people reporting on people. And over the decades, we've had several instances where the government has gone to librarians, who many of us think of as the gatekeepers of freedom, asking them to not only report on readers' habits, but turn suspicious people in. And librarians have bravely found ways around that. But I think that a combination of human beings reporting on others, we saw the development of so-called crowdsourcing, which worked actually effectively after the Boston Marathon bombers, where people were asked to share clues and they came together. And of course, one person's tip resulted in the apprehension of those two individuals. I think there's a fine line where information, obviously, from the public can be useful for legitimate law enforcement purposes. The problem that we have now is lack of standardization among law enforcement, lack of explanation to the public about how those programs are used, making sure that the evidence collected meets standards of admission in court. But I think you have in-person reporting on the one hand, then programs like Ring, and then, as we've discovered through Pegasus, obviously, countless programs that most people are not aware of around the globe, where third parties are accessing not only our personal information, but that of the governments. And I think that the irony here is that so many government programs have failed, especially to root out terrorism. And in fact, the government, especially legislators' lack of knowledge about technology, has not kept abreast with technological developments. And the way that the government and corporate partners safeguard large databases is sloppy in most parts, leaving our information vulnerable to third-party hackers.
Speak a little bit about Pegasus. And this is obviously in the news now. The New York Times just reported a couple of days ago on a data leak to a consortium of news organizations. I mean, tell us about that. I mean, it seems highly underreported. And I think there's yet to be, there's a lot of dots to connect here in terms of how this information travels and ends up being used by governments in a way that isn't necessarily obvious at first.
Pegasus is an app that was developed by an Israeli defense organization that is able to be surreptitiously and remotely planted, as it were, on both Android devices and iPhones, Apple operating systems. And what it does is it essentially monitors and is able to capture all the information on all of the apps that one may have on that device. They can also install a microphone and actually listen to everything that you say. So it's kind of a nightmarish application that in effect puts a little police officer or detective in your back pocket, able to monitor every communication that you have, no matter what the format, and even to listen in on you. The problem is we don't know how many people's devices this is on. We don't know how many other programs like a Pegasus exist, so that I agree it's underreported and it should be revelatory and horrifying to anyone who understands the repercussions of it. But what it means is essentially if you have a device and you use different apps to communicate with friends, colleagues, others, and that Pegasus is on your device, you have no privacy whatsoever. And your data can be extrapolated and shared with other parties and used for a range of purposes, both from marketing, but with more insidious practices. The worst being identifying you, for example, as a terrorist or something that might lead to your apprehension and loss of liberty. I think it's probably just the tip of the iceberg. That kind of technology coupled with the lack of awareness and tech savvy that we see in American courts and legislative halls, to me, means that individuals have to be even more scrupulous about knowing about possibilities like this and taking measures to safeguard how they interact online and how they try to protect their data, certainly better than most people are doing right now.
It also seems to me that one of the big problems in terms of affecting us as individuals, because I don't know, I mean, you know, I think your average person probably wouldn't have necessarily, there wouldn't necessarily be a direct threat from something like Pegasus, although at one point it could be just sort of like deployed as, I'm a hedge fund and I want to know where to put the, you know, the best place for me to put a supermarket, you know, is essentially. And I know that by assessing everything that this person does by their phone. I mean, we already get that in terms of tracking. But the place where I think we start to feel it, at least, and I would imagine many people feel it now and don't realize it, is that this is deployed against journalists. And journalists are aware. I mean, I know of journalists who have been, they're not sure, but they have been contacted and they've been told, like, yes, you're being monitored. You're writing something about the, you're writing something. I mean, you know, Khashoggi's was monitored and his fiance monitored. And we don't, I mean, maybe that led to his death. We don't, I mean, it's very possible. But also we know that stories can be inhibited. I mean, it's interesting because when I started doing this, I remember an interview that we did with someone from, I think it was the Columbia Journalism Review. This was 15 years ago, who said that they were, that there were reporters who were intimidated by all the letters and emails. This is 15 years ago that they would get from the radical right in this country, and it would inhibit the way that they reported. This dynamic exists. It's even far more problematic, it seems to me, when a government, technically despotic or not, begins to intimidate reporters, and we're not going to hear certain things from our journalism because they're afraid to track it down. They're afraid to get caught up in it. I mean, whatever it is.
That's exactly right. In my book, I mention the reporter, award-winning reporter, Cheryl Atkinson, who under the Obama administration came forth with a story about a botched gun running operation that the government knew about. An agent or two were killed. She then had her home devices monitored for a period of time and a court case. There were admissions that she had been monitored. James Risen from the New York Times, other people have been monitored. We, especially under the Trump administration, there were several covert efforts to acquire the records of journalists, especially reporting on national security issues that are of grave public importance, trying to get information on who their sources were. There's no federal shield law, and there need to be stronger protections for journalists. But I think right now, even though a month ago, the Biden administration withdrew a gag order that the Trump administration had put on the New York Times after it sought records from them. And I think Biden is paying more attention to the attorney general guidelines that lay forth how entities can request or subpoena information on reporters. But I think the chilling effect that has on what journalists feel safe reporting on, but also what sources feel comfortable coming forth with if they know that their identities are at risk of being revealed for coming forth. We've seen how whistleblowers, including Ed Snowden and many others, have been so crucial to peeking into the surveillance apparatus and getting a sense of the extent to which it pervades our lives. Whistleblowers know going forward that they are going to risk their liberty and maybe even their lives. We see what Julian Assange is going through. And I think a risk is that if we do enact laws to protect journalists, then the issue becomes who is a journalist? And there's a concern that it may only cover a certain layer of individuals who engage in news reporting rather than the many solo actors who, through social media, are engaged in important endeavors to bring us news that you don't hear about in the corporate media. So I think spying on reporters and their sources goes really to a fundamental right of First Amendment freedom and the public's right to know.
This is a bit of a tangent, but on the Atkinson, who admitted what in regards to what she was saying? If I remember correctly, she said she had some pretty wild claims about her computers being taken over and certain things happening that seemed rather dramatic. What were the admissions?
I read one of the court filings in which the judge did acknowledge that devices had been put in her personal and home computers. They were analyzed and they actually traced them back to a government entity. But it was something like the post office. It wasn't, you know, Department of Justice or the FBI, but they found a link to the U.S. government. The judge admitted that in court. And I know she wrote a book about it. And yes, some of it seemed out of a science fiction movie. But I think the takeaway from that is that, especially if you are an outspoken journalist, in James Risen's case, he also, in a book that he wrote, reported on a flawed operation under the Bush administration. I think if you are dealing with high stakes critique of a certain presidential administration and you expose something they're embarrassed about and they'd rather hide, you're open to some kind of retaliation.
Yes, I mean, in general, I accept that point. I have some questions about the Cheryl Atkins and stuff. But that said, let's talk about a couple of other of the myths you talk about. We should worry about government, not corporate surveillance. There, it seems to me, there's really no difference, right? Because any corporation, I mean, you mentioned Ring. Has been essentially used as a surveillance tool by police departments across the country. There's actually like a third party that essentially networks these things and then provides it to police departments. But I would imagine that the NSO group that did the Pegasus that they could sell it to anybody. I mean, in fact, corporations are increasingly being used by government agencies as a way of getting around legal restrictions on what they can accumulate, what kind of data, and they just go and buy it from these corporations instead of setting up the surveillance mechanism themselves.
That's totally right. Corporations don't have to adhere to the strictures of our Constitution. I think something like 80% of our intelligence operations have been outsourced to private entities for a long time. And I see them as working hand in hand. I think the perception among some people is, I don't want, you know, hands off me. I don't want to be spied on. I don't want government interference. And yet those same people aren't as suspicious or maybe aren't as aware of how hand in hand big business is, in fact, with government agencies. I know that years ago, I used to work at the National Lawyers Guild, and we did a lot of work defending or observing protesters at mass demonstrations and rallies after 9/11. And we were acutely aware of the many different ways that the government, with private support, was monitoring and spying on activists. And I think I became interested in this field in part because of that. But the more I read about it, the more I saw that it's not just activists, it's all facets of society, especially with the commodification of our data, which is a multi-billion dollar industry. Corporations will essentially do whatever they can do to get more information about us, because that information translates into profits for their bottom line. But I just wanted to highlight the fact that they are so interconnected that people need to start being equally suspicious and vigilant about how corporations do intrude on our lives. Again, in a more kind of wild, wild west fashion, given that they're not highly regulated and privacy protections, including in how our devices are actually built, they're built with an eye toward making us more addicted to clicking more and more and to linking to more sources so more people get our information.
And we should say that there is no, I mean, I think people assume that if it's illegal for the DEA or the Highway Patrol or whomever it is, doesn't matter what agency, if it's illegal for them to surveil and get this information without a warrant or without any cause, they assume that it would be illegal for them to buy it from somebody who is allowed to get it by signing off a term of service sheet, right? I mean, we put these apps on, I get, you know, on my computer and or my my phone, and it sends this data, and these agencies can buy it. There's no restriction on that whatsoever. I don't think people, appreciate that dynamic.
That's exactly right. It's sort of, you see, on old police procedurals, the lawyer says, well, I can't get that information. Or the police officer says, I don't have a warrant. But they find a way around it. So they get it through another means that is legal. We see that kind of end run being done every time we click on something. So I hope that people just being more aware of that, and I think we're getting the cookie warnings every time we go to a site, people have the option of making a choice. We're coming around to sensitizing individuals to take more control over their personal information. But as you say, if we want to go to a site and we need information quickly, we click on the I approve. We click on the terms of service without reading the fine details. And I think there has to be a seismic shift in business practices in that respect.
I mean, you were at one of, I guess, myth 11 is metadata doesn't reveal much about me. But why is that not true?
Well, metadata, or what some people call data about data, is really the nature and the origins of a piece of information. So the NSA may say, we collected a million phone calls, but we didn't listen in. But what they did get was, I phoned the abortion clinic. A day later, I phoned a certain doctor three times. Then I went and visited another help, I called a suicide hotline. So with that information, researchers have shown they were able to identify individuals with particularity just out of watching the pattern of information. And what happens is algorithms are applied to the metadata that sift through and make, you know, reduce all those connections very quickly. So it becomes an effective telescope into your activities and your associations. And through your associations, they can make determinations about, you know, what political affiliation you may be, conservative, liberal, if you're religious or not. Information that I think applies with all the other information, one of the dangers is it can be used to discriminate against us in any range of healthcare, housing, benefits, jobs. That's one of the overarching reasons that we don't want everyone to have our personal data, is we don't know how it's going to be used against us now or in the future.
And we should be clear, you know, that the aggregate of personal data, even if it's not down to the individual, can then be applied back on you and discriminate against you because you are part of a group. I mean, we saw that in the context. I mean, we saw this, frankly, in the 1930s with redlining, right? I mean, this was we're going to take the more or less the metadata of a certain neighborhood. That metadata is going to say, like, okay, this is going to be redlined. This is an insecure place in which to provide loans. Sometimes it was based on race. Sometimes it was based on other factors. And then that redline data not only makes it harder for you as an individual to get a loan to buy a car or to buy a home, it also means that you're very much more likely to have a highway being built through that area during the 1950s when we start to expand the federal highway system. It also means that you're more likely to have a power plant put there, which means that you're more likely to get asthma if you're a kid. I mean, it just continues on like this because this data can end up discriminating against you because you're part of a group that comes out of this metadata. All right. So lastly, you know, you write, you know, we've touched on some of this, but the myth is that there's nothing I can do to stop surveillance. We can be more discriminating in when we sign off one of those cookie things, but what else can we do?
Well, a real sore spot for me is the fact that our leaders are ignorant about this topic. I think we need to start reading the newspaper. I read the business section every morning. Start taking note of things that you can write to your elected officials about, expressing a viewpoint, write an op-ed or a letter to the editor. Start talking to your friends about these things. Pick an issue that you care about. Support organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation or whatever your cause may be that really specialize in electronic freedom, privacy, empowering individuals with knowledge so that they can then take action. I think we as a society can't be complacent at this point. Get signal on your phone. Just be aware of the many ways every day that you are under assault by marketers and by others. And I think, you know, go to a crypto party, meet other people who may not know that much about technology, but others are willing to share. We're all in this together. It's a virtual community in many ways. And I think that it's incumbent on us to force our leaders to become more educated. Our judges need to get out of the typewriter age, learn. I mean, so many unfair decisions have been made in court that are related to cybersecurity or individuals who have experimented on the web. I just think we have to shift the whole conversation and not be afraid to talk about technology.
Well, the book is I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. We'll put a link to that on majority.fm. Heidi Boghossian, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, and we will be back in just a moment. We'll be right back. So, folks, just wrapping up things. Again, you know, I think it is important to have a nuance in the context of this stuff. It's very hard for, I think, you know, people to maybe split the difference on some of them. I mean, I do think a certain amount of like social pressure is good about on some topics, on others not. And I guess that's just, you know, up to the individual. But it does get very worrisome when our data, broadly speaking, and when our opinions and maybe endeavors that we're doing that threaten some of the power bases get scrutinized to that degree where it begins to silence. I don't know, her book mentions the Chinese social credit system, which apparently is like an amalgamation of a different types of things locally and provincially and this and that. But maybe we'll do more in depth on that in the future. But it is a little bit disturbing, I have to say. It's like you get demerits if you litter. Or you get bonuses, like, you know, cheaper internet if you don't, et cetera, et cetera. I think littering is bad, but nevertheless.
Sunstein obsessed with, like, nudging people? Is that kind of it?
I mean, sort of, although it's a little bit more explicit than that. It's not so much a nudge. It is like a stick and a carrot, but there's a stick. All right, well, folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye. See you tomorrow. And if you're not, I'll get more explicit on that. Apparently what it is with the, and I need to read more into this. I hadn't been aware of it, that you, in like I say, it seems to be, not as a national of a program. It's more sort of like, you know, maybe nudged on a national level, but like each citizen gets like this is how, in theory, it works. Each citizen gets 1,000 points at the beginning of the month. And you can lose, you know, 100 points because you're seen, you know, littering or something, or somebody can report you. Or you can gain 100 points because you, I don't know, went and helped somebody who had a flat tire or something. It's a little bit, that's a little bit scary. Feels more like a TV show. That said, we're going to move on to our own show. We call the Fun Half. 646-257-3920 is the number. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. I just want to say thank you. We got a bunch of emails. We had some folks who had, more personal relationship with Michael who wanted to call in yesterday and couldn't get through. We just didn't have the time. And there was other people who just wrote in some very sweet remembrances of Michael and just very, very nice notes that folks sent us. And we can't necessarily respond to all of them. I'm trying. We got a lot of them, but I want to thank everybody for their response yesterday. It's, you know, I think I can't remember who made the point that you're talking to the microphone. You don't really know. Maybe it's Waz, I think, said this. You don't know if anybody's listening. It's very easy to get isolated and, hearing from folks, it's quite nice. And I think also, you know, it takes a couple of years before you start to realize the level of intimacy that happens when people, you know, can watch you on their computer or listen to you like, you know, radio. It you start to, you know, your voice and, literally your voice, but also just broadly speaking, your, personality gets, you know, sort of like interwoven into people's, brains a little bit. And a lot of people, you know, write like, I'm very surprised on how attached I was to Michael. And I didn't realize it until he was gone. It's a phenomenon a lot of people, you know, experience. You don't necessarily have to know somebody, personally to build that type of attachment. And I don't think that's a, you know, in any way abnormal. Just want to, again, say, appreciate the response that we had from people. It was very nice. Reminder, tomorrow night, Nomi Key's show, youtube.com, The Nomi Key Show. And you can find it on twitch.tv, the_Nomi_Key_show. Matt, Left Reckoning tonight?
Yeah, tonight, Left Reckoning, David and I will be talking about the Jacobin just released a article written by Michael that he originally intended to put in Esquire, and they didn't like how, I think, ideological it was, but about how we need people like that have a history of being on food stamps, covering Trump's, you know, attacks on, you know, SNAP. It's a really interesting article. Dave and I are going to talk about that at the top of the show. And also Lillian Chichurkia. We're going to be talking about the problem with post-Marxism. David has a more philosophical interview there. So tonight, 8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our post game and everything else. So that's tonight, 8 Eastern. Subscribe on YouTube.
I hadn't seen that piece. Is it in this month's Jacobin?
Yeah. I think Jacobin just posted it yesterday. Megan Day tweeted it out.
All right, great. We'll put a link to that in our podcast and YouTube description today. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. And we will take your eye.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can we bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.